House Committee on Consumer Protection for the Oregon Legislature, 2007. The date is January 26th. Today we will be having public hearing on House Bill 2109, 2111, and 2112, with a possible work session on 2111. So with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2109. Steve, would you give us a preview of this bill?
Happy to, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2109 divides content of existing construction contractor statute into smaller statutes, adjusts statutory references to existing statutes, and makes regulatory subdivisions for other political subdivisions the same as limitations for cities and counties.
First up, could we have the Construction Contractors Board, Craig Smith?
Good afternoon, Chair Hulvey, members of the committee. My name is Craig Smith. I'm joined today by Bill Boyd with the Construction Contractors Board. This is a fairly lengthy bill for CCB, but it really is designed not to change policy at all, except for to correct one small issue having to do with treating cities and counties the same way as all political subdivisions. The intent is to make the statute read easier. It's one of those statutes that's been amended probably a dozen times over the years, and it's just kind of got meshed up. So that's what this bill does, and we would be happy to entertain any questions.
Representative Nelson. Thank you, Chair. I'll just ask one because it seems like the right thing to do. Otherwise, it's kind of not a hearing, right? No. what does the your problem, your current problem, what was the purpose of those different treatments of those entities?
Mm-hmm. Chair Hulvey and Representative Nelson, we can't figure out what it was.
Oh.
We believe that it was a mistake years ago. This was something that was pointed out to us by legislative counsel when we asked them to fix this, and they suggested that there's no practical change, and we thought, well, if it's just an error, why not fix it now, as far as we know.
So follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, please.
So, Craig, what I'm hearing is just this is simple. All of these entities, subdivisions with the cities and counties, should all be treated the same, and so that's really it. Period.
Chair Hulvey,
we don't need all this other writing in here.
Well, now I Chair Hulvey, and I've said Nelson, I stand ready to be corrected in case anybody has a different opinion. But that's what the way it was related to me by the folks that were working on this draft, and we didn't ask for any policy change. So that's what I believe is the case.
All right.
Other questions from the committee?
I understand how these things happen. I never understand.
Mm-hmm.
I think 3 years they can only get from you.
So, Craig, I know that we're not moving forward with this bill this time because there's some concerns from some other folks that have an interest in this bill. Can you address what their concerns are, so that we can sort of have a concept of why we're not moving this forward, what we could look for when it comes back to us?
Yes, sir. Chair Hulvey, we have two issues. We have a technical correction that Mr. Boyd can speak to. We'll have him do that in just a second. Something that we caught that was a mistake, but again, shouldn't change the public policy. And then we do have an issue that came up during the course of the summer that has to do with plumbing and electrical contractors and a glitch in the law that prevents CCB from pulling the license of a CCB licensee in the event that same person's license is revoked over at the Building Codes Division. We thought we had that authority. We sought to do that kind of activity, and after checking with our AAG, she indicated that we do not. So we believe that that ought to be corrected, and we'd like to get an amendment that would achieve that goal.
Thank you. Mr. Boyd, can you introduce yourself for the record and maybe address the other change?
Yeah, the other this. My name is Bill Boyd. I'm the dispute resolution manager for the Construction Contractors Board. The other change has to do with Section 9 of the bill, which makes some conforming amendments to ORS 279C465. That provision provides that if a person is in a competitive bid for a public project and they lose that bid, they're the second bidder, for instance, and they discover that the low bidder has violated certain statutes, they can challenge that and do a suit for damages, essentially, for the lost profits that they suffered because this other bidder should have never been given the job. One of the statutes that it talks about violation of is this very statute that we're breaking apart into smaller statutes. And so really talk about the whole statute. Now, many of the provisions of 701055 deal with are not things that you can even violate. They deal with certain things that the CCB has to do and so on. But there are a couple of them. There's about three of them that actually could be violated. One of them is the requirement that a contractor be licensed with the CCB in order to do construction work in the state of Oregon. And we believe that that was the intent of this other statute that's in Section 9, is they were aiming at somebody who isn't licensed at the time they make their bid, or maybe at some other time, maybe they become unlicensed during the course of the work on the project, and as a result, their bid should have been invalidated, or their work should have been allowed to do the project. There's a couple of other provisions that make some requirements for a contractor to give notice to the CCB when they change their officers, and another one which requires that the that they maintain a list of subcontractors. Those provisions are in 701055 for purposes of the CCB to make it easier for the CCB to enforce its regulations. And we didn't think that should be grounds for a lawsuit between two private parties that has really nothing to do with those two provisions. And so what this amendment we're talking about doing is would take those out of the bill, would take that out of Section 9 so that you could only go after somebody who was working unlicensed.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee on this? Further questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen, for this overview, and we'll wait for those amendments and take another look. Time I close the public hearing on House Bill 2109, and I'd like to open a hearing on House Bill 2112. Steve, why don't you go ahead and give us a rundown on this bill and we're going to ask the CCB to come back up again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill requires, House Bill 2112 requires construction contractor whose mandatory insurance or alternative form of security ceases to be in effect during term of license to provide construction contractor board with evidence of suitable replacement insurance or form of security, requires notification of CCB when insurance or alternative form of security ceases to be in effect.
Thank you. probably shouldn't have had you sit down, but I saw you had to get your papers anyway. But would you restate your name for the record again on this? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Halvey and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Craig Smith. Again, I'm joined by Bill Boyd. I bring Bill up. Bill is both a lawyer and an engineer and a manager here at the CCB. And when it comes to technical items, he's terrific. He's terrific anyway. But that's the reason why we have him up here. Also worked at Legislative Council for a while and speaks that language, and very, very handy man to have at the CCB and in state government. Members of the committee, this is a sensitive issue. It has to do with the liability insurance coverage that a construction contractor is obligated to carry and provides financial accountability in the event of an accident or, in some other cases, damages on a construction site. It's sensitive because the insurance requirement for contractors has been a bone of contention for a number of years, particularly in this state, but all over the nation, because of the cost and availability. About 2 or 3 years ago, I guess 2 years ago in 2005, the Construction Contractors Board, because of some complaints from many, many Construction Contractors Board, passed a resolution that declared an emergency because of the problems that licensees were having getting this liability insurance coverage. We believe that that's one of the main reasons that the Construction Claim Task Force was formed to try to address this problem. And they will have a variety of issues, as you well know, that they'll bring to the committee to try to help with this problem by reducing construction defects and thereby helping to address the insurance crisis. With that said, the law currently does require that insurance coverage. And the way it works is that a contractor has to provide us with proof of that liability insurance at the time of licensure. The problem that we've had is that in some cases we do not get notice when a contractor loses their insurance. We rely upon the records that we have, and so does the public, so that when we have a website or a database that indicates that a contractor has insurance coverage, and if in fact they do not have that coverage, that's a problem. First of all, they're in violation of state law because they don't have the insurance, and we should be moving to suspend that license because the public's at risk. Secondly, as I say, other licensees and the public, to the tune of about 100,000 website hits a month, check our records to make sure that someone is licensed and in some cases have that proper insurance coverage. So we are looking for a way to make sure that the licensee has that coverage or that they tell us. Originally, we sought to a solution that would require the insurance provider to provide that notice to CCB. We've been informed that that's really not doable. It's not a practical solution. And so the only alternative is to put that on the backs of contractors. Now, that's a burden, and I won't dispute that. For a contractor to notify the CCB if they don't have their insurance. But we think it's a reasonable burden under the circumstances. We would work to try to make that as easy as possible, including providing an electronic solution so they could go out on the website and merely click a button and tell us they don't have the insurance if, in fact, they don't. Now, I want to be clear, if they don't have insurance and they give us information that they don't, we will move to suspend the license. But we think it's necessary. We ran into a problem with this bill, and we've been working with Mr. Powell to provide a Dash 1 amendment. Perhaps he'll be speaking to that later on in this hearing, and we'd ask you to consider the concept, give it some favorable consideration, and to allow us to come back with a Dash 1 amendment that would address the concern expressed by the insurance industry, which is that it's not a practical solution for them to notify CCB. Can I answer any questions?
Questions from the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, and you asked for some indication. I do want to let you know that I think it's a very good idea for people to know if the insurance policy has been canceled, but I share your concern about who's going to provide that notice. So do I correctly, you talked about the Dash 1 amendments, which apparently don't exist yet. Would that be taking out paragraph 5 lines 7 through 12, and paragraph 3, line 29 through 34.
We're working with, I believe that's correct, we're working with Mr. Powell to make sure that that gets accomplished. I can't tell you that those are exactly the lines that would be eliminated, though I believe that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions from the committee?
Yes.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Something haywire with these bills if Representative Domenici's remark was correct. Because the part that's going to be changed is not line 7 through something else.
Mr. Chair, could I address that?
Go ahead.
Okay. Representative Nelson, when I was approached by Craig Smith and John Powell, and they specifically asked me to strike line 7 through 12 and 29 through 34.
Could you read
7 through 12 on page 2, sorry, and lines 29 through 34.
Exactly.
Okay, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Follow up.
The way I've been reading these for the past 8 years, almost 8 years, this starts with line 1 on the second page.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I guess subsection 5 is what they had asked me to strike. I do have a copy of the bill that they marked up for me too. I guess they might be able to better answer that. Any further questions,
Craig or Mr. Boyd? Would you like to jump into this apparent confusion over what is being proposed to be stricken?
Well, Chair Holvey, what I can tell you is that yes, I would. Ever so gently. As I say, we haven't gotten to legislative council, or I haven't yet. I'm working with Mr. Powell. It's the intent to take away any requirement on the part of the insureds to provide notice to CCB regarding cancellation of a policy for one of their folks, and to put that burden on the back of contractors. I can't tell you precisely how that's going to be done, but I can tell you that's what we're going to ask legislative council to do, and I'll work with both the insurance industry and agency council to see to it that gets accomplished.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so the record is clear, I believe that what the intent is not to take the burden away from the insured, but the insurer.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
One last follow-up, please.
Representative Nelson.
That's what I get for being an administrator, right? We understand one another. Thank you, good chair. But can I ask you, how are these subcontractors handled? Is the primary contractor responsible? Do these subcontractors, I don't see anything in here requiring them likewise to ensure their work.
Oh, yes. Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson, requirements to be a construction contractor are pretty flat. So a general contractor has to have a similar requirements as a sub. A primary contractor or a general contractor has an obligation to have a $500,000 worth of insurance, and a subcontractor has an obligation to have $300,000 worth of insurance.
A sub does.
Right. What we call a specialty contractor.
Oh, okay. I see that word now. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions from the committee of the Construction Contractors Board at this point?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, but did he say $300,000 or
$500,000
for a sub?
I'll let CCB answer that question. Representative Nelson.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, it's $300,000 for a residential-only specialty contractor, $500,000 for a general contractor or a licensed developer.
So follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Nelson.
So this other $500,000 for all other specialty contractors relate to what?
Yeah. Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson, that's for a commercial contractor. Contractors who want to be able to do large commercial projects would have a license that I'll call an all license. When I heard you ask about a sub, I was thinking residential, and those kinds of contractors require a $300,000 insurance policy.
So, Mr. Chair, I was just wondering if we could suggest that in the amendments that they specify this, you know, this category C is commercial work. Otherwise, it's very misleading.
Do we, Craig, do we have a definition of specialty contractor in statute?
Yes, Chair Holvey, there is a definition of specialty contractor. I'd have to grab my statute.
Just so that it's clear to address Representative Nelson's concern, but I believe that it is already spelled out in statute what it refers to.
Right. And the other thing, if I could elaborate a little bit, you will be getting a bill this session that will split contractors in a whole new way. For the last 30 years, it's been like this. I agree with you. It's somewhat confusing. What I understand the industry is bringing to us, to you, for your consideration, is a bill that would split contractors very clearly into a residential camp and a commercial camp. And I think that would satisfy this concern very well.
It would, yeah. Yeah, it would. Thank you.
Committee, any other questions? Well, thank you, gentlemen, again, and I'm sure we'll see you very shortly on another bill. Next up, I would like to call Stephen Kafori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafori. I'm representing the Oregon Remodelers Association. This is one of the few times you're going to see me before you this session disagreeing with the Construction Contractors Board. Usually we have a very close relationship, and we almost always agree on everything, but we have a problem. The Construction Claims Task Force, you heard a report from them the other day, and as I said in front of this committee, observing what had happened as a result of that task force, they were given the job of coming up with something to help the insurance crisis, and frankly, they did not. And we are still, we being the construction industry, are still in the problem of having huge increases year after year in our insurance, and in many cases not being able to get insurance at all. I would like to have my folks up here testifying with me today. Unfortunately, I can't. We just had our first meeting last night of the year since the session started, and you guys are moving a little faster than we had anticipated. So we just had an opportunity last night to discuss this bill. I would like, especially if we're going to bring back an amendment, Mr. Chair, to have an opportunity to have some of our contractors come and tell you what the problems they're experiencing and why this bill would be a problem for them. One of the issues is that why do people have lapses in their insurance? It isn't because our folks are bad guys out there. What happens is that we have insurance policy that lasts, say, for a year, and as the insurance, the end of that insurance year comes up, we go to our insurance agent and say, the end of the year is coming up. What's going to be for me next year? Am I going to still have insurance? Can I keep the same carrier? What are my rates going to be? And recently, because of the upheaval in the insurance industry, we have not been able to find out. And it sometimes goes right up to date, and all of a sudden they say 2 days before, I'm sorry, your insurance carrier is not going to cover you again, and so we are without insurance. So what do? We stop working because we know not only is it illegal to operate without a license, but it's also very dangerous financially for us because if we would operate without insurance and something happened, our assets would be at risk. So in the real world, what we do is we stop working and we lose money. Then we get another insurance, some more insurance coverage, or maybe a week or 3 weeks later, It's not, you don't just call up the CCB and say, I've got my insurance back, and they say, okay, you're reinstated. It's quite a process. It takes a time to have this happen. So what we would like is for us to manage that ourselves, not have to go and call the CCB and say, hey, guess what, our insurance lapsed, and then have to go through the difficulty of getting reinstated. We would like to just quit work ourselves and then start work again when our insurance comes. Also, we are unhappy about this, taking away the requirement to have the insurer give notice to the CCB. That may not be practical. I don't know enough about insurance to answer that, but I do know there's a problem about them not giving notice to us. And what we're concerned about is not so much whether the insurer gives notice to the CCB. We're worried about the insurer company giving notice to the contractor, to the insured. And we would think that a 60-day notice would be a good, would be give us time in this difficult insurance market to find somebody else who can give us insurance coverage. And I would like to bring my folks down and explain that problem. One of the issues that we have a problem with, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to repeat this a couple times during the session, that is that the Construction Claims Task Force, when asked what was the cause of high prices for insurance, responded without looking, I think, at the other options. They said, well, it's the high cost of claims, and there's no question there has been an increase in claims. But it's our impression that there are a lot of other factors that go into the cost of insurance besides high cost of claims. For example, what's happening with the insurance company's investments in the stock market, and there's pretty good correlation if you look over the years as the insurance rates go up. It's when the stock market's doing well and the stock markets go down, all of a sudden there's a problem. Inverse relationship, but I mean parallel. And the Construction Claims Task Force did not look at any other options. They came up with this solution that if we just cut back on construction claims, then insurance costs will go down for contractors. Yet if we ask the insurance companies, is that the case? Can you draw me a straight line and say that Portland claims go down, our insurance costs will go down, and they can't, which leads us to be suspicious of the whole situation. That's my testimony, Mr. Chair. I'd like to again bring my folks here and tell you about what we're having trouble with.
Thank you very much for that testimony. Questions from the committee? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Chair Halvey. Thank you, Mr. Kifori, for your testimony. I have a question about your proposal on the 60 days, and I understand the concern of the insured remodelers in your case wanting to know if their policy is canceled. But what we're talking about here is both when a policy is canceled and when it expires. And I wondered, and certainly if it expires, they know when it's going to expire because they know the term of the policy. So. In the real world there and of the remodelers, how many are canceled before the term is expired?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I'm perhaps using terms interchangeably that I shouldn't. I'm talking about the end of a policy period. At the end of the policy period, and we would like to be renewed for the next policy period. But in order to be renewed, we have to have the insurance agent tell us, yes, that company is happy to renew with you again. And if they say no, that insurance company will not renew with you again, then we need to have the insurance agent find another insurance company that will. Now, the problem is if they give you 2 months' notice, say, yeah, it's now the 1st of November, and December 31st, your insurance policy is going to end, and we're not going to renew you, then we have 2 months to go find another company that will insure us. But if they don't do it until December 24th, then we've got, you know, a week to go find another insurance company that will do it. And that's our problem.
Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Representative Belizio.
Yes, Mr. Kifori, I just want to see if I am clear. Excuse me. Is it the contention of the remodelers and contractors that you're representing that under no circumstances should they be communicating with CCB in terms of the status of their insurance? In other words, you're just saying flat out that it's just too much of a burden. Like, no matter how sort of simple it can be made, whether it's just an online. You're just saying they shouldn't have that responsibility?
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, the problem is it may be simple to get, to let them know. It's not simple to get back reinstated again. You can't just call up and say, I got my insurance to say, fine, I'll push the button and now you're covered. But you're now relicensed.
Follow up? Yeah, so I understand that it's not easy, but there's no objection to if there can be found a way that seems feasible to have the contractor communicate with the CCB. Are you just, see what I'm saying? In other words, I'm not talking about whether or not or how difficult it might be to get the policy. I'm just saying. I mean, it seemed to me that you said that it should be up to the contractor once he or she no longer has insurance to quit working, and that under no circumstances they should have to communicate with the CCB. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, yes. The problem is getting back with the CCB, getting relicensed after you're unlicensed is difficult to do. The other problem is that during that period of time where you don't have, your license has been revoked, that goes on your record. So somebody who's looking at whether they're going to hire you or not checks out the CCB on the website. They find Jones Construction Company doesn't have any insurance, and their license has been suspended. We may be in the middle of a bid process at that point. Or we may have somebody who's thinking about hiring us. And maybe we're going to get insurance the next day, but at that day when they look at us, it says, my gosh, you don't have any insurance. So they go on and hire somebody else.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this question is not for Mr. Kafuri. I can't believe I said that. Kaduri's Hong Kong. Mr. Kafuri, thank you. But I think my question is for Bill Boyd.
You want to see if he can work for legislative counsel while we have the
I do.
Bills backing up?
No, I. What I'm.
For work.
Well, let's finish with Mr. Kafuri first, and perhaps we can get CCB back up.
Well, could I ask him this question then?
Mr. Kafuri?
Yes. Well,
certainly.
Okay. Well, what I see in this, I think maybe I'm just having a bad hair day, which is almost every day. But I cannot see in this bill how we can mandate that an insurer not cancel the policy, which is the way I read this. That's why I was wondering if I could have that legal mind over here to help me with mine. Here, it's almost like your repair people, refurb contractors, under this clause, will always have insurance because it says an insurer cannot cancel the insurance. That's how I read it. Page 2, lines 29 to 34.
Well, Representative, with all, I understand that too, but that is the section that they've indicated that they are striking out in proposing to strike out in an amendment. So, not sure whether that's a good contention at this point. But do you care to comment on Representative Nelson's comments there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, my only concern is that in the time when the end of the contract period with the insurance company is coming to an end. We want them to give us notice before, so that when it does end, we've had some time to prepare to get another insurance coverage.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you for indulging me. Thank you, Mr. Kafuri. It seems that might be something that would be part of the contract between the insured and the insurer, but not part of the disclosure requirements of insurance coverage in the construction contractor requirement.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, we don't have a lot of bargaining power when it comes to writing these contracts. If we say, no, I wouldn't sign an insurance contract unless you give me 60 days renewal time, they'd say, thank you very much. We're on the weekend right now of this negotiating situation. The insurance companies have the power, and we don't. Especially if you look at a number of our the vast number of our members, the people in the industry, are very small shops, one, two, three-person construction firms. They don't really negotiate contracts with the insurance companies.
Thank you, Mr. Kafouri. Any other questions for Mr. Kafouri? I think you've made an excellent point, and something we'll probably keep asking a few questions about. Thank you very much for your testimony. At this point, I would like to call Jessica Adams. Adamson, excuse me. Didn't see the O-N at the end of your name.
Chair Holvey, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors, and I apologize for my poor handwriting. Here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors to testify in support of this bill. We like it in its current form. We believe it's very useful, not only to the CCB and for their function, but for contractors who rely on the CCB website and CCB information for information on our subcontractors about whether they've got their bonding in place, whether they've got their insurance in place. When you're managing a job that may have 20 or 30 subcontractors, the condition of a contract is that you have your insurance in place and it is viable. You want to make sure that at no time is any insurance lapse, that your subcontractors are properly insured, properly bonded. Because if they aren't, you, as a general contractor, assume that liability in a hurry. If something happens while they're on that job, and though in a perfect world all contractors would cease to work when they don't have their insurance, unfortunately, that is not always the case. And it is damaging to all parties if the insurance lapses. When we find out in the current world that somebody's bond may be canceled or is on the verge of being canceled, and they provide that information to the CCB, we, as the contractor, we find out about that, we are able to intervene and encourage our subcontractors to get back in compliance right now and provide that kind of leverage, and we find that is a pretty effective tool. It protects us, and it protects our clients, and it protects everyone else on the job site. If we were able to have that information about insurance, that would enable us, again, to better protect our customers, our clients, and quite frankly, if one sub has a problem on a project, every other sub has a problem on a project, because construction is so time sensitive that if one sub doesn't have their job done because their insurance has lapsed or they're not able to be working, it throws the entire project for everybody else, and time is money in construction. We think that this is an important bill. Our concern is that without the insurers participating in the notice, that the incentive for those who have their insurance lapse to provide that information directly to the CCB is, there's quite frankly a disincentive. Why would you willingly provide that information to the CCB beyond the fact that it's part of the law? I'm not really sure, knowing that your license would be suspended at that point until you get back into compliance. We believe that having the insurers participate, and I know that my colleague John Powell is sitting in the back room cringing at this point in time, and we're happy to work with them to craft an amendment that will be suitable to them, but also I think serve the useful purpose that this bill was designed to do, which is to provide timely information not only for on the residential side, because my folks are commercial. On the residential side, that's very useful information to homeowners. But on the commercial side, we see this as useful because, again, it keeps the ship moving. And if we see that there might be a problem coming down the pike, or there is a problem, we can get that problem fixed right away, as opposed to finding out about it 30 days later or 60 days later or not at all until there's a claim on the project, and then we find out that the person was working while the insurance was lapsed, and then all of a sudden it's everyone else's problem. We don't think that's right and fair, and we think that this bill is a good step in terms of sharing information and will make the contracting world better.
Thank you, Ms. Adamson. Could you tell me then that I'm not sure if you were in the room. You were just out when they were discussing that that they were going to be seeking an amendment to strike lines 7 through 12 on page 5 as well as lines 29 through 34. So you would be advocating to leave those lines in. On page 2, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, we would advocate to leave those in. And again, understanding that this is a burden on the insurers, we're willing to work with them to see if there's a way that we can reduce the paperwork and other difficulties for them to do that. But we believe that insurer participation is a key component here, because our concern is that without the insurers at the table helping to provide that information, the voluntary, despite the fact that it would be state law, the reality is you are dependent upon contractors to provide that information directly to the CCB in a way that it's adverse. It's like asking somebody who's speeding to walk down the courthouse and pay a fine on themselves because they were speeding it. They shouldn't be speeding. They should pay the fine, but they're not going to turn themselves in. So I think our concern is, realistically, this law has efficacy only to the extent that you have the insurers at the table helping to provide that information.
And can you clarify one more thing for me? Mr. Corey had in testified that, you know, oftentimes the contractor themselves don't get the notice from the insurers that they're being canceled. Is your experience similar?
Mr. Chair, cancellation and expiration are two different things. I think the cancellation piece is what we're more concerned about, knowing that the cancellation is coming. I think, you know, it is true that when the market was especially tight a couple of years ago, that contractors wouldn't have a whole lot of time to renew their insurance, that they wouldn't necessarily get a bunch of quotes up until perhaps the last minute, and that is especially true for those in the residential industry, and I appreciate that situation. However, it was the experience of the commercial industry that, despite having a short period of time, that there was enough time to get a quote. May not be the quote you want, it may not be as competitive as you want, and it may be much more expensive than the prior year, but that there was, unless your experience was just horrible, there was an opportunity. It would be nice if we had significantly more time, but that aside, we found that there was always an option, that the insurance was available, the exception being multifamily housing units, and those are handled separately, but general liability insurance was obtainable.
Any other questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. And I hope this is, I can get a question in here. I guess it's more food for thought. I agree with the intent of this bill. I think it's very important for everyone to have involved in the process to be insured, and it's also very important for everyone to know who has insurance and to know when they aren't going to have insurance. But if there's also a goal here to help keep insurance costs down, I don't know. I hope that you and others can get together and find out a way to get to the goal without causing increases in your insurance rates. Because if, in fact, you are requiring the insurer not to cancel the policy and to keep the policy going when there may be circumstances that justify cancellation, I think you're going to see a significant increase in your rates. So that's just my concern. I really look forward to seeing something magical that you all can work out that will get to the intent. Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Hobie. Thanks for being here, Jessica. I'm curious, how big is this market? Are there very few insurance companies that do this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, It depends on the kind of construction that you're doing. Oregon, what we know overall is that Oregon represents about roughly 1% of the national market. We are not a driver. We are the kind of market where it is optional to write here, unlike California, which is a major market. Oregon is relatively small, so keeping insurers writing here is a issue for us, and we certainly don't want to scare insurers away. And so I'm very sensitive to that, and I'm sensitive to the concerns of the insurance industry because we don't want to give them a reason to not write in this market. And again, multifamily housing in particular, and this has a real effect on affordable housing, obtaining insurance to do this kind of project is very difficult and in some cases impossible, which is why there are different insurance products for those projects. Overall, commercial general liability insurance for many sectors of the industry is certainly much more expensive and more difficult to get than it was, say, 10 years ago. But there are two or three insurers riding in this market that are not in the surplus lines of market.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. Jessica, did you say there are only two or three vendors?
Well, that are direct writers. You know,
okay.
CNA and
thank you. And the rest of my question is there an allowance for these contractors to self-insure?
Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, we have, if you can put together the money, I suppose you can self-insure. AJC specifically has looked into creating a captive that would provide an alternative insurance product. The capital necessary, and I know my other construction industry association friends have also done so, and AGC chapters across the nation have looked into this. The difficulty in creating a captive is the amount of capital necessary to undertake that kind of thing, and then the loss control necessary, and the folks that meet the parameters that you would want in your captive are able to get insurance on the general market at a pretty favorable rate. So it's capital intensive. You're looking at tens of millions of dollars to start a captive, and then the folks that you would let in, you're not necessarily creating access or room in the market for those that are in the more, high-risk pool. So yes, you can self-insure, but by the time you get to the point where you can self-insure, you can get insurance on the market, and your issues of access aren't, there's no real advantage.
Representative Galizio.
A question of the chair.
Do I have to allow it?
Well, I'm just wondering if we're going to be hearing from Mr. Powell. Is he scheduled to speak?
Patience, my son.
Well, I'm not impatient. I'm just curious, because if not, I want to ask Jessica, Ms. Adamson, certain questions.
Yeah. Well, I was about to ask, okay, if Mr. Powell would, because the insurers are the missing piece in this discussion, so I would ask that perhaps he's come up if in fact we're through with questions for Ms. Adamson. Thank you so much, Jessica, for your testimony, and I hope that you will perhaps work with this illustrious group to come to a solution on this important issue.
Absolutely.
Thank you for indulging us, Mr. Powell. If you could state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell. I represent several insurers, including State Farm Insurance Company, AIG, and Liberty Northwest, doing business as North Pacific Insurance Company, writing property and casualty insurance in Oregon. Mr. Chairman, I did not sign up today because the amendment was not ready in council. As you know, they're buried, and it's no one's fault. When it snows and the snow gets too high, we can't go anywhere. It's snowing. So let me begin by trying to clarify a couple things. First of all, you will unlikely find a proposed regulation or a proposed statute on insurance that already isn't a regulation or a statute. So that's almost a given. The law does require an insurer to give 45 days advance notice on a non-renewal. And it was Representative Shields' bill last session that moved it from 30 days to 45 days. The reason for the change from his original bill was 60. The reason we agreed to go to the 45 days is that the state of Washington had a 45-day advance notice. And the reason they had a 45-day advance notice instead of 60 is the portion of the policy period that's involved. Because if you start going back to 60 days, those decisions in the insurance company are going to have to be made 30 or 45 days before that in order for all of this process to work. So you're asking the insurance company halfway through a policy period to be making decisions on renewals. And so the 45-day period seems to work. If in the case of a contractor who is not notified, that policy will remain in effect for that period of time. So they do have an avenue to resolve that problem to get more time. In terms of cancellation, again, the law is very strict on insurers, and those are found in ORS 742-690, limitations on cancellation, refusal to issue or renew insurance. And in mid-policy term, you can cancel for non-payment of premium, for fraud, for substantial increase in the risk. For example, if somebody said they're building homes, and the insurer finds out they just contracted to build a 35-story skyscraper in downtown Portland, totally different businesses. Failure to comply with loss control recommendations, that is, if it's clear that they're in violation of safety standards and they continue to do that, the insurer could cancel. So the reasons for midterm cancellation are spelled out in the law, and for periods of time, 10 days to notify, and then the person has 10 days to correct that problem. If it's non-payment of premium, once they get a cancellation notice, they have 10 days to pay it. So the law is replete with those kinds of regulations on insurers. The problem with the provision in the bill before you and the issue before you, there are several problems with the provisions of the language that's in the bill. And it's not so much that an insurer would have to notify the agency. The problem is how many notices are they going to get? Take auto insurance. State Farm's the largest auto insurer in Oregon, about 18% of the market. They send to their insureds every year thousands and thousands of cancellation notices because people are slow in paying their premium. The law, again, gives the consumer a period of time after that notice is delivered of coverage. So if the insurance company waits until 10 days after the policy period is renewed and then sends the notice, they're still on that risk. So they send those out promptly. And they would have to do it in this case as well. In most all of those cases, the consumer pays the premium. So now another notice would go to this agency. And that would be very problematic. This language goes beyond that and creates a 30-day period. So now the insurance company, if they wanted to terminate this policy, would have to send the notice 30 days in advance in order to be off the risk on the day they should be off the risk. So this language creates several problems. And then the final problem is Jessica mentioned surplus lines carriers. That's Lloyd's of London and companies that are not regulated by the insurance division. And the reason surplus lines is allowed to write coverages is there is a limit of capital available in any line of insurance. And in some cases, businesses resort to surplus lines coverages, where, as in the case of Lloyd's of London, they're actually investor groups who pool their money to insure risks, such as boats crossing the ocean with a lot of cargo.
Airplanes.
Airplanes, big buildings, those sorts of things. Those companies would not be sending these notices, most likely. And so you would get some and not others. It was my understanding that the CCB plans on developing an online system for contractors to report this information to them. And again, we'll cooperate in sitting down and talking about all of these issues with the stakeholders that are present. But I just wanted to make sure we got on the record that most of the issues that were talked about here today have been considered and action taken.
Thank you, Mr. Powell. Any questions from the committee for Mr. Powell? No questions. I thank you for your testimony, and I hope that you will meet at your earliest convenience with the CCB and the AGC and the remodelers, and see if we can put together something that works, because I think the intent of this bill is very important to the consumer, first of all, as well as the contractors and our agency in trying to make sure that they're accurate in their representations of the industry.
Mr. Chairman, I might also respond to the concept of subcontractors and generals. I have clients who require me to send them copies of the declarations page for my auto insurance, for example. I have two clients that require me to carry at least $1 million in auto liability insurance in case I'm on a mission for them, driving my automobile, hit somebody, they could possibly be sued for that. And in the case of construction projects, particularly large ones, I think it is customary for the general contractor to require subs to do the same thing, so that they know that there is coverage when the policies lapse or expire, and in some cases I think are actually named as additional insureds, which means they would get notice of any change in the policy provisions.
Mr. Chair, can I ask one question?
Representative Nelson, another question.
Thank you. Thank you for being here, John. The bonding capacity is, there's not much in this world, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, there's quite a bit of bonding capacity in terms of companies bonding projects. Again, on large projects, many times there's a requirement for a large bond. When you get to covering every single contractor that Oregon law requires, there are some limits in terms of bonding capacity, because you're being asked to put at an insurer is being asked, in essence, to put $10,000 or $15,000 of cash on the line against the failure of these contractors to operate. And the premiums are relatively low in that area. Otherwise, you couldn't require them. So for every loss, it takes a huge number of people paying in premiums to pay for that. So when everybody has to have it like that, there is a limitation on how much bonding capacity there would be. If you simply said every contractor has to have a bond equal to the sum of the projects they're currently working on, that'd be in this day and age, for just a home builder building a few homes a year, would be hundreds of thousands.
Thank you very much,
you.
Mr. Powell, for filling us in on the missing link. With that, I have another person signed up to speak on House Bill 2112, Bill Gustiski. I apologize for not being able to pronounce your name. So there's two bills.
This is Artie Kuzman. I'm a member of RABA, and he's the president of the association. And
can you state your name and what group it is? RABA? What does that stand for?
Russian American Builders Association. And my name is Billy Gustevsky. I am just a member, a small contractor out of Hubbard, Oregon. And we had a lobbyist that his vehicle broke down, Lane Barlow, so he would probably be speaking on this bill later. As far as my understanding of the bill, it's trying to put the effort of the contractor to prove that he has insurance through his period that he's licensed. Me as a contractor, when you come in to get a CCB license, you gotta provide them with a certificate of insurance and an additional insured. You provide them that proof, and then they have proof of when you started and when it's supposed to end. Now, as far as additional insured, and with me working with also subcontractors, anytime anything happens with that insurer, as far as a subcontractor, I'm always notified if it has expired or has been canceled. So as far as this way the system has been working, I think it has been working just fine as far as being notified. And I think the CCB has also been sending out notices before your insurance expires, at least 60 days, notice that's stating that, make sure that you provide insurance, by your deadline. And I guess that's all I can come up with at this point. So, any questions?
Thank you. I'll ask if there's any questions from the committee. Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Chair Hovey. I just want to commend you men for making the effort to be here today, because something's very important to you.
Thank you.
I just wish we had more citizens like you doing the same thing.
Thank you. And I'll leave you with a quote. Politician always looking out for the next election. Statesman is always looking out for the next generation. So we're here looking out for the next generation.
That's great.
Mr. Chair, I don't think they need lobbyists. I think
they're
fine.
I agree.
You could save some money.
Thank you for that. Is there anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2112? If not, I close public hearing on House Bill 2112 and open a hearing on House Bill 2111. Steve, would you please let us hear a little bit about House Bill 2111?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2111 requires construction contracting business owner claiming status as a responsible managing individual, exercise management and supervisory authority over construction activities of the business, authorizes the construction contractors board to adopt rules defining management and supervisory authority over construction activities of business.
Thank you, and we'll have up the Construction Contractors Board to give us a preview, and you can introduce yourself for the record again on this bill.
Thank you, Chair Holby. Craig Smith with the Construction Contractors Board. If I can, I just want to apologize to the committee for the confusion from the last bill. Apparently, the contractors board hasn't done its homework, and we're going to take care of that and bring that back to you in better order.
Okay. Great.
Appreciate your choosing to try to hear the bill today.
That's what our committee is supposed to do, so don't apologize.
This, I hope, has a little less controversy. Right now, the Construction Contractors Board has a license requirement that, of course, requires a human being, because we license businesses. In many cases, it's corporations, limited liability companies, but somebody has to take the test. And so it's an owner, an officer, or an employee in some cases who's authorized to take the education. It's a business class. An 80-question test, and this usually goes in pretty good order. But we have seen some information that tends to make us believe that in some cases the person who's taking the test and qualifying for the license is not involved with the business at all, but rather is it appears to be a bit of a fraud. And we believe that's the intent of the assembly, and it was the intent of the folks that sought this license requirement, the testing requirement, that somebody who took the test would also be involved in running the business. What this bill would do would require the RMI to have a management role in all cases. Today it's just a management role if indeed it's an employee. If what this bill would do is expand that requirement so that if the responsible managing individual who qualifies for the license is an owner or officer, they'd also have to have a management role in the business. It's our intent to make that fairly easy to comply with. We would have that just on the application, indicating and certifying on the application that the person listed as the responsible managing individual, in fact, has some management responsibility in the business. It's a fairly simple bill. We'd appreciate your favorable consideration.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee?
I have a question.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you be a little more specific about the kind of fraud that you suspected or seen?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gilliam, we believe that in some cases individuals for fee may be offering to qualify as the RMI, get placed on businesses, and then not actually run the business.
Kind of a subcontractor.
It doesn't go there.
Any other questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I'm going to ask one if you're going to lead this to vote today.
Proceed.
Thank you, then. Craig and Bill, I guess what I'm concerned about is that we become so specific that our men and women can't even do their jobs. I mean, dear goodness. I guess I'm concerned because individuals go away, they go on vacation, blah, blah. You know, they're not there for emergency proceedings, so forth. So, you know, they have many different jobs projects going all over the state. And I'm just curious, it just seems like we're getting very restraining. And I just wondering if you see that in this new correction to this bill.
Okay. Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson, I think I agree with you. I think that there is some restriction here. I think the policy issue that's before you is, I think your question is a fair one, and that is, is this a legitimate request or a mandate for a construction contractor? And in my mind, it is. What we're looking for the person who claims to have taken the test or otherwise qualify to be the responsible managing individual, at least certify and, in fact, be a partial manager of the business. Wouldn't indicate that they're there all the time, but we believe that this activity that may be going on, that we have pretty good evidence to the effect that it is, clearly is circumventing the intent of the legislation that required a contractor to have some testing before it's out in the field.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, please.
So, Craig, are you going to go to every one of these jobs and see, you know, who's the RMI? And, I mean, goodness, this is just, seems like this is just going on and on and on.
Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson, no. No, it would be the intent of the board to put a new line on the application that indicates that the applicant is certifying that the responsible managing individual that they list on the application actually has some role in managing and running that business. If, in fact, we receive some evidence that that's a fraud, that that's not true, we'll investigate. And it will be incumbent upon the state to prove that that is not true, and that will be somewhat of a difficult task. And I don't anticipate doing that very often. But I would at least like the authority to be able to put such a declaration on the application to indicate that the person signing the application indicates that indeed this responsible managing individual has some control over the company.
Follow up, Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Okay, so Bill and Craig, what it sounds like a TV show or radio show. Bill and Craig, could you tell me what's the sanction then if you find out that my son-in-law or my dad or either one of my brothers aren't at a job and some angry employee calls you and who got fired because he didn't show up?
Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson. In my mind, and I don't think this legislation requires that responsible managing individual is at the job. Matter of fact, in most cases, he or she wouldn't be. They would probably be in a small business, the kind that I ran or the kind that many of us may have run. They would be bidding a job while the workers are working on it. This does not require the responsible managing individual to supervise even on a daily basis those employees. That term is strictly for the purpose of qualifying that human being as the test taker. And as the test taker and the person who required the education, they're supposed to be able to avoid problems with contractor regulations. If they're involved in the business, they'll be able to make sure that that business doesn't cross those lines. If it's just a test taker who, for a fee, provides this service to the business, then I think we've sold that contractor short. I think we've done a disservice to the contractor by letting that business operate without somebody who has had that training and passed that test. So, ma'am, to directly answer your question, we would not be going to job sites making sure that the RMI is at the job site. We would only investigate to determine whether or not a business had an RMI who, in fact, someone told us really wasn't running that business.
Representative Galizio.
Yeah, Mr. Smith, can you tell the committee how many contractors or advocates for contractors, lobbyists, contractors of any size, whether it's a small shop, large, have come to talk to you in opposition to this?
I don't know about it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Galizio, both comments are fair. I think the answer is we've had no one come talk to us to indicate that it's a bad idea, but although we have not hit this, and we have talked with my friends at the Home Builders Association, and I just yesterday talked with the folks at participated in a meeting with the Remodelers Association. They did not indicate that they were in opposition to this. And if I may, as I left, the remodelers are important to us. And the comment that Mr. Forey gave to me as he left the room was he wanted me to be able to pass on to you that he supported this bill. So I'm here to tell you that.
Thank you. Any other questions?
May I ask one more question, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Gilliam?
So just so I completely understand this, right now, you're assuming anybody that came and took the test and signed off actually was involved in the business, but can they just say, I am, if they're a professional test taker, they can just say, I am employed by this company, and that's all they have to say? What's the requirement now, I guess, is what I'm getting to.
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative Gilliam, right now the requirement is that an owner of the business or an officer, which would be a corporate officer or a member of the LLC, would have to qualify as this responsible managing individual. And they do that by indicating that they have a background in construction that involves, it's a little bit complicated, but it means that they were involved with the as a licensed contractor for several years in the past. Or in most cases, they have to show that they passed the test. And the problem we've had is that what's happened is in some cases, after we ran records to find out who the RMIs are on which records, we have one RMI that's on about 20 different licenses, and they seem to be unrelated, except for the fact that this person has is a member of the LLC or in some cases is a corporate officer of these many varied businesses.
Mr. Chair. Craig, I want to ask a question myself at this point. Not that there would be a need for it or a use, but just kind of throwing this out. Would there be any reason or anything in this bill that would prevent a business from having more than one responsible managing individual?
Yes, Chair Hovey, no, there would not. That's perfectly fine, and we would expect that. In many cases, the industry in the commercial side for condominiums and such open up a separate business for each project. And so a single RMI could be on many licenses. The investigations we've had and, frankly, the offers for sale of the RMI status that we've seen are not of that nature. Therefore, businesses that appear to be looking for someone to qualify as the test taker as opposed to separate businesses that the individual actually operates.
Thank you. Question, Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Chair Hovey. You know, I have a hard time understanding this purpose of this bill, but more importantly, when you look at the bill and you look at the summary, the summary says that it's going to authorize the CCB to adopt rules defining management or supervisory authority over construction activities or business. At the same time, we're saying in this bill that it's simply a responsible managing individual. So either that statement needs to be taken out of the summary, or we need to hold this bill and put the amendment in here that, you know, as you define what you think this means. Does that make sense to you? Okay.
Sure. And of course, Chair Holley and Representative Nelson, the summary is not prepared by the agency,
right,
if you will.
Right. I don't know why they let the CO put it in there.
Any other questions of the Construction Contractors Board? If not, thank you very much for your testimony, gentlemen. And next up, I would like to call Stephen Kafori, and if Jessica Adamson could... Oh, he's not even... Is he not here anymore?
Yeah, substitute.
Okay. Mr. Scott Berry, would you like to come forward and join Jessica Adamson? That would be fine.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors in strong support of this bill. Responsible managing individuals of a company should be folks that are either owners or are in involved in the day-to-day operations, as some are in small businesses. The owner is also the guy out there doing the work. In a lot of cases, they're the folks back at the office bidding or looking over the financials. They ought to at least be somewhat involved in the company. And we have heard reports of folks that for a fee, $1,500, $2,000, say, hey, I'll take the test for you since you can't seem to pass the test, and I'll sign off as a corporate officer, and you can go ahead and do your business. And as long as you don't get in trouble, we'll never hear from each other again. AGC thinks that's inappropriate. We think it's fraud. We think it's bad for the consumer. We think it's bad for the construction industry. Certainly isn't the kind of face that we believe that should be out there. If you can't pass the test, you shouldn't be a contractor because it's an open book test. You shouldn't be able to sell your RMI status. That's all this bill does. And we are comfortable that the rulemaking process and defining management supervisory issues is going to be a collaborative process. We are comfortable that the CCB recognizes what is and what is not supervisory management and the wide range of sizes of businesses and the kinds of things that RMIs do. We're comfortable that the CCB isn't going to take this in for legitimate RMIs that are part of 3 or 4, even sometimes 10 different businesses because of the LLC factor on these large commercial projects, that those aren't the kind of instances, and we're not concerned a bit about that. But the instances where someone is indeed, in our opinion, committing fraud by saying, oh, I'm the responsible managing individual, and they haven't taken a look at the company's books or talked to the person who's actually doing the work in months, years, we think that's inappropriate. We think that's something that shouldn't be occurring. And unfortunately, the law allows that to happen now, and it shouldn't. And this bill fixes that, and we think that's it's an important bill, and encourage you to move it today.
Thank you. Mr. Berry, if you could state your name and give us a little comment.
Sure will. Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association, and I'll be very brief. I think Jessica covered most of the points that that we would cover as well. I might simply add that with the additional education requirements coming before this committee for construction contractors, I think this bill is even more imperative simply because before we had the test, we had a registration process, and I think the type of fraud that we've seen was even more rampant than it is today. And with the with the test, we thought we would remove some of that. I think we certainly have, and raise the bar a little bit. If additional education requirements are passed by this committee and by the legislature, we're going to see more of that as the test and the education becomes more difficult to comply with. We certainly might see more of that attempt to fraud and to provide the service of passing the education for a fee. And I wouldn't be surprised if that fee goes up.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? So, as I guess I'll just ask a question, make a comment. Jessica, do you see that, you know, in my question of the CCB, that there is an opportunity to have more than one responsible managing individual in a company, that would be a pretty common practice in large companies?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holt, or Mr. Chair, absolutely. In many, many of our companies, there are several RMIs. And that's just a function of corporate structure.
So you don't see this bill as limiting that in any way?
Mr. Chair, I do not.
Thank you for that. Representative Nelson, have you got a further question on this?
No, sir.
Any other questions? Well, thank you so much for your testimony today. And with that, I would like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2111 and open a work session on House Bill 2111. Do I have a recommendation from a member?
Mr. Chair, I move that we... I make the motion that we move this to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Riley moves House Bill 2111 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, may we have a roll call vote?
Aye.
Representative
Riley?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Bonamici?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Aye. The motion, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I would like to put forward, somebody would like to carry the first bill out of this committee to the floor, and Representative Gilliam, would you like to be the appointed person to do this?
I appreciate the offer. I would like to clarify, until the bill passes, you can get $1,500 for taking this test, and it's an open book test. Is that right? Yes, sir. I would be happy to carry this.
That's for being prepared.
For the record, Representative Gilliam will carry the bill to the floor for us, and appreciate that. At this point, I'd like to close the work session on House Bill 2111, and seeing no further business before the committee, I adjourn the committee.